Welcome to Sound Method, a podcast featuring inspiring audio creators from across the world of sound and the techniques they use in their best work. I'm your host, Noah Snyderman. Today's episode, Radio Arts with Gambletron.
Hi, I am Gambletron. I'm a sound artist based out of numerous locations at this point, originally from Montreal, also Los Angeles, and now the interior of British Columbia. What you're listening to is a sound sculpture that I built called Mixed Motor that I just showed here in Vernon, BC. It's basically the sound of an antenna kind of creating feedback between the sound of like a transmitter and a receiver meeting in the form of two pieces of metal. So we have the antenna against a slab of sheet metal, which is sitting on top of a piece of wood, so it can resonate. The way it works exactly, if I were to give away the magic, the technical magic of what's going on, is that if you look carefully at the picture, you'd see like a small circle, and that's a surface transducer. So what I'm doing is I'm simply feeding the radio into the metal via surface transducer and then attaching all the antennas that interact with the metal to my cheap Amazon FM transmitter, which is hovering above the project. That's how that became. And
okay, so I want to, first of all, thank you for being on the podcast. But with that explanation, so I've been watching this clip and trying to wrap my head around what it might be. And now that I hear it, I just need to know, like, how, like, where do these ideas start for you?
They don't really start as ideas so much as they start as a result of messing around. So one thing usually leads to the next. And with this piece, it started with a previous piece that was done like 2 years ago, I think. I never remember my own timeline, but it was in Berlin. And the first piece, which is really similar to this, is called Antenna Forest. And Antenna Forest was meant to be a sequel of another piece that I had made for the Victoriaville Musique Actuelle Festival. I was curated there to make a public sound art. So what happened was, is that public sound art became a chapter two in Berlin. But then while I was building chapter two, I made a discovery while I was building it in a very different way from the first time, that when two pieces of metal touch each other, there's like a feedback if one piece is attached to the transmitter and one piece is attached to the receiver. You know, on many levels, I'm still just trying to experiment. Like, I'm not a technical artist in the sense that I don't necessarily ever understand what I'm doing to the fullest extent. You know, like, to me, it's like, it's almost magic, like how I've like traveled this far, like with anything, like even just building circuits or like circuit bending. Like early on when I would circuit bend, people were like, oh, you must know so much about electronics. And I was like, actually, no. And I think that's why I'm so successful. And I'm lucky that I haven't hurt myself.
So Lisa, you said in our emails that Gambletron is like a book kind of divided into chapters. And I think I went about this all wrong, because I asked about the most recent chapter and then we've gone backwards, and you never go through a book that way. So why don't we go back to the first chapter and go from there? Could you kind of walk us through what the chapters have been, sort of starting at the beginning with your sound art?
Yeah, sure. I can go all the way back to the 90s where I was a folk singer. It totally had nothing to do with sound art, except that I met this guy, Howard Billerman, who owned a studio, and I had joined a band and started learning how to be a drummer, because this band convinced me to be a drummer. And kind of all those things came to a head because I didn't have money to get a drum kit. I was pretty poor, so I was just banging on garbage. I wanted knowledge to be able to talk to sound engineers when I got into the clubs. I was getting more and more popular and playing like larger shows on bigger stages in Toronto and in Montreal. This is like 95 to 99. And Howard took me under his wings and taught me all about sound, which was super cool of him. He literally like made a workbook for me and stuff, but he owned mom and pop studio, which later became Hotel de Tango in Montreal. And Howard Billerman is a pretty renowned sound engineer. So I was lucky. He taught me about all sorts of different microphones and how sound worked and how the studio worked. And, you know, bit by bit, I learned, even though it all seemed very bizarre and abstract and counterintuitive, he gave me the greatest gift ever, which was a quarter inch tape machine and a little splicing kit as a gift. And it was so cool. And he taught me how to make sound loops out of quarter inch tape. And that was pretty much like, I credit Howard to my exploration at that point. Like I took that and I ran with it. And at that point also, like, I was getting more in rock and roll kind of in my brain too, a little more punk rock. Like, I think I already always had kind of an edge, but I was playing acoustic guitar and writing songs. So it's like, at that point I was like, okay, bang on crap. And like, I'm going to make sound loops. And I would come out, I'd drag this huge machine with me and I'd put on a loop and then I would play guitar to the loop for the whole show. And I think that led to me like experimenting with recording and more loops. I went like loop crazy for a while, but it was the 90s. There's not much documentation of any of that. But, you know, we all had a lot of space to experiment in. I lived in this amazing loft with my friend Spanky, who had, it was like our garage. We lived on top of a garage, kind of in a loft, and the garage was a big music studio. So that was really an incredible place for experimentation. And it all kind of led to me quitting art and music, going to Taiwan and teaching English. I quit it all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was like, I can't be an artist anymore. This is ridiculous. I'm never going to make money. This is terrible. And then I went to Taiwan and my guitar broke. So I had to build a new guitar and I made it out of like a film canister and a piece of wood. So there we go again. You quit, but you don't really, it's a condition or a religion. I'm not sure. Anyways, and Taiwan happened for a bunch of years. And then I came back to Montreal because Montreal is my home and my people are there. And at that point, things were getting really good for a lot of my friends and bands. Like Godspeed kind of got famous and like, oh, it was like, I guess the beginning of the Arcade Fire years where that band was lifting. And, you know, I knew that folk music, like I hadn't played music in that capacity in a while and I didn't know how to reinsert myself. So I got this like kid's toy and I had like heard about circuit bending and I was just like, I'm just going to like yell into a mic because that's how I feel and play with this kid's toy. And that's how Gambletron began. It was probably really terrible in the beginning, but this band named Thundra kind of found me and I joined their band as like the texture noise person. I guess we played post-punk, but I didn't really understand what that was. I thought our music was extremely unique and original. And then we started playing with other bands that sounded like us. And I was like, whoa, it's like a scene. Like I wasn't there, you know? At that same time, I became a DJ. There were all these amazing queer dance parties. It was a good time. And then I joined some touring bands. So I started touring with some Constellation projects, namely one called Hirschta. And then I was in a band called Clues, which was also on Constellation Records. Constellation Records is like the Montreal label that got big because of Godspeed. And they kind of do like post-punk or post-rock and kind of more abstract-y kind of music, I guess, if you don't know Constellation. And then I met Carla Bozulich and started playing with her and her band. I was always kind of like a drummer and a weird sound person. I started playing very seriously, playing musical saw at that point and putting the musical saw through like as many pedals as I could and trying to figure that out. So it sounded really like doomy and it's a very Constellation-y kind of sound, but it worked with Hirschta and Carla. And then I also played drums a lot. And then Gambletron was just like this thread all the way through. And at that point I was just playing like dirty noise shows in dirty lofts with my dirty friends, like, you know, and it was usually at the beginning of a dance party or something. There would be like a couple of like, it was getting more and more popular to be like a one person, like electronic act. Like there was like a scene of that. And some of it was like more like electro dance and somebody might sing with their like MPC or whatever, or like somebody else might, like me, I used a lot of little hardwares and tiny synths. And like, I'm not a computer person. Other people start bringing up their computers or like there was like a whole scene of people that like only made music with Nintendos, or like, you know, how there was like a whole lineage of that happening in the beginning. And so Gambletron was that for a long time. And then I don't know, like, I got tired of touring and I started kind of cluing into the idea of like more sound art ideas going on, but I didn't know how to enter that world. And then noise music in general always had a bit of crossover into the art world because it's experimental and very abstract sound making. And that was, I think that was my gateway with galleries like Eastern Bloc, which like media galleries, or Studio XX, which was like supporting specifically, trans and women and non-binary people in electronic media arts. And I started doing workshops about circuit bending, even though I'm not the expert of the universe, but if I can do it, you can do it. So, and then more recently, my partner, I started collaborating. Well, actually it was my ex and I did some kind of more art-based sound work, like gallery-based sound work. And we got a residency in Berlin, but previous to that, I hadn't really done much. And then we broke up, and then I ended up being connected to this person, Johnny Forever, who, like, on an artistic level, we had friends who were, like, Johnny was looking for someone to collaborate with, and they were a performance artist and a video artist, and, you know, I'd heard about them through friends. People were trying to like set us up artistically, and except that then we fell in love and we're a couple and married, but we do collaborate still together. Like artistically, we've always collaborated, and Johnny had always had a stronger connection to the art world. So that was kind of the last straw in bringing me into galleries and into that world. Cause we've done a lot of collaborating in residencies and at festivals, and both our worlds, actually, there's crossover, because I've also, when I play a show, I'll often like show works by Johnny behind me, or like, well, now straight up, we do a lot of like performance art together where there's like maybe a media element and like a drag element, maybe like a costumed element. And I usually work with radio now. I'm really obsessed. So the lineage is I don't fight it, and it goes to all sorts of different places. And if somebody wants me to play a noise show, I still do. Like I'm happy to get up on stage and just play a bar. I just don't do it as much. And now that there's a pandemic, guess I won't be doing any of that music stuff for a while.
So, Lisa, I want to turn to radio now, because something that I think is so cool is that, I mean, radio is something that almost all of us think of as consumers. Sometimes, you know, people like myself maybe get the opportunity to do campus radio, but the idea of radio being a tool, an act of resistance, I mean, there's so many ways you've used it, so I'm not going to try to make a list for you, but how did you discover radio, and kind of take me through that journey?
Okay, well, okay, so we're going to step back one more. I was hired by Richard Perry, a friend of mine who's an Arcade Fire, to build a project for him at a halftime show. So Pop Montreal was going to have like a basketball game. It was called Pop versus Jocks. And there was like all these rock and rollers against the all-stars of McGill and Concordia basketball, all-stars, like almost like Olympic level players against a bunch of indie rockers. And then those indie rockers stacked their team with NBA players and women professional players. And that was really funny. And then, of course, it was for charity. Money was, I think, all going to Haiti after it got demolished by a storm. And if I recall, anyways, halftime show, Richard has this idea. He wants to do 16 bicycles, each bike with a boombox on it. And he's going to make a sound piece with 16 tracks. And each track is going to be on the back of each speaker on each bike. So, and the bikes are going to go all over the basketball court. And so he's a busy guy. He's an Arcade Fire. Arcade Fire is pretty big at that point. And so he hires me to do it. Of course, you know, in the gamble way of things, I decided to do it that we'd all have iPods and we'd all press play at the same time, which is the most archaic way of dealing with that tech. But it also, in many regards, like it was like the most like foolproof, like easiest, cheapest possible way. And he, you know, being an Arcade Fire, was able to just simply ask Apple for 16 iPods and they said yes. Unbelievable. And I went out and I probably built the whole thing for like under $200 after that, because I went out and I found like 16 boom boxes that I mounted on the back of each bike. I had to put aux cables into a lot of the boom boxes, which is actually pretty easy to do. And we did the piece. And at the end, Richard disappeared and I ended up with 16 boom boxes with 16 radios. And that was kind of fun. So they hung out in my studio. And my friend Charlene's boyfriend sent me a YouTube video of some guy with three radios having created a theremin. And I was like, oh, that's super cool. And his question to me was, hey, do you know about this? Do you know how to make it work? I can't figure out the electronics. And I was like, ah, shit, I don't know. And I dove into it and got totally obsessed. The project is called 3 Radio AM Theremin. And it's originally credited, oh, I always forget his name. It's credited to this guy from 1999, where he took three radios and he tuned the... They interact with each other and they create an oscillation. And then you make one flip of a wire inside radio number 3 and you can control it like a theremin against the wire. It's all in the AM range. So I did the project like they did it on YouTube. It was like an old German man or somebody that was showing me how to do it on YouTube. And I figured it out. I wrote this guy back. I was like, I got it figured out. It's very cool. This is how you do it. The instructions weren't easy. And then I couldn't stop playing with it. So by the end of the week, I had like all 16 radios in play, and not just three radios, but I had like totally extended it to this like multi-tonal theremin. And I seriously, it pushed my art practice. Like that project was like, I was obsessed. And so I could, for a long time, for like a bunch of years, I would just set up radios, and I still set up the theremin, like multi-tonal AM radio theremin. And I would play saw mostly with it. I used to start a lot of my Gambletron sets with it. Like I just set up a multi-tonal theremin, because for every two radios, I think you'll have to look at my website to see it in action. But anyways, the point is like you have one radio that's a controlling radio and you need a pair of radios to dial in a note. And only of those two radios, only one radio has sound in it. And I was working with something like 30 notes. And like if you tune the radios, you can tune the note. And then if you go to the controller radio, you can play the wall of sound like a theremin, which is super cool. So that was like a big, big rabbit hole, that AM radio theremin. And that's what I brought initially to Berlin the first time, that project, the multi-tonal AM radio theremin. And then the whole concept was to perform with it. And I think that's really the beginning. Now that we're talking about it, like that was like the deep beginning of sound art as like in a gallery space-ish, or like in art space versus music space. And AM radio theremin, you know, of course, my next natural go-to was like, I want to take an AM radio and broadcast into the theremin. So that's when I built the AM transmitter. And that's at that point when I started doing that. And that was like the basis of my work that time in Berlin too, was to like experiment with that particular feature. Sadly, it doesn't. It sounds like garbage. It didn't work. It's garbage. It doesn't work. It's terrible. It sounds terrible. It sucks to have a transmitter in the room with the theremin. Like, it kind of works, and I was able to pull off some components of it. Like, but basically, I had to separate out radios that were playing music versus radios that were the theremin. Like, they had to be two separate structures. Yeah, you know, some ideas, one thing erases the other, and it just didn't work. So now I use FM radio. If I do work with any transmitters and play along electronically, originally, like when I was touring with the multi-tonal AM radio theremin, I was just going through like an amplifier. But if I broadcast what I'm doing, I'll do it on FM. So the AM radio theremin is on AM, and I'll broadcast on FM. And those two don't interact badly. It's not awesome still. Like, the theremin doesn't love a transmitter. The theremin is really exciting because it actually reacts to wind, to the electronics in the room. Like there was a show in Leipzig where like a train kept going by, like a streetcar, an electric powered streetcar. And that was, it made my whole setup go berserk every time a train went by, which is awesome. Like I love that. I love, love improvising with like all the mysteries, all the technical failure. It's all bonus to me. As much as it can also give me a headache. Like I've had some truly horrible shows because of technical failure and like interactions that were unexpected. But I mean, that's, if we're talking about improvisation, like my musical practice isn't like, a lot of it is me improvising with mistakes or mysteries that occur because I have way too much crap plugged in at once. So, and the radios are lovely. It's like almost playing with like ghosts or like spirits. Like, and that's kind of like a place I've been kind of headed because now I'm kind of interested in exploring that topic more of like radio being used as like a way to communicate with like another dimension of whatever you want to call it. God. It's how I'm going to talk to God, some God, spirits, ghosts. But like since forever, there's like a history of that, you know, of radio for the use of communicating with the spirit world. I think right down to Tesla, like there's like a whole history of people talking about that. So that's a more recent thing. So that brings me into a more recent place of my artistic meanderings. But yeah, I think that theremin was really the basis of how I got into radio. And then it was an instrument which really agrees with my musicianship. Like I am a musician first and foremost. I play in bands still. Like I play in a band called Orchestra Criminale. It's like an 11-piece klezmer-ish band, and like I'm a musician, and so my projects are often instruments and created for the purpose of playing or interacting with or performing with. And radio, I got the FM transmitter. I heard about it at a festival. This guy straight up walked up to me and was like, "Do you know about this Chinese FM transmitter? It's like an incredible machine. Yeah, I think it would change your life." And like this guy totally cornered me and told me about it. He was like, "I'll send you an Amazon link. It's awesome." And it is. And they keep making it under different names. So I can't, it's not like it's like the Syntec 2400. Like it's like the same, you got to go looking for it. It's a 7-watt and it has a secret setting. It's a way too powerful FM transmitter that you can get from Amazon. And I buy them, I break them, I buy them again. They're like under $100 and hopefully they'll never stop making them because they're awesome. They're also very dirty sounding and they're maybe dangerous. Maybe we'll find out.
So I'm wondering, when you're creating an installation or maybe when the installation's already set up, how are you thinking about timbre?
Timbre. I kind of just roll with whatever comes out. Like, that's a good question. I'm guided by the technology. I just give it the space to do what it wants to do because it's hard to control. Some of the sounds are really complex, especially with the theremin. There's a lot of like extra tones and sometimes texture that can come out. You know, I kind of also flip-flop between like enjoying the pureness of what's happening with the thing that I've created versus trying to guide it into a place that's maybe more musical. A lot of sound art, you can get away with lots when you call it sound art. But my problem is I get bored. I get so bored and I get annoyed when other people's art is just like, I process is so much a part of it. So I can appreciate certain things based on like how they got to that place or how the process is happening. But I personally, like, since I can control what I do, I very earnestly love a lot of the dirty sounds that I'm creating and can listen to them for long periods of time. I do acknowledge that other people cannot. And there is something to be said for accessibility, and I'm willing to spoon feed a little bit so that an audience can withstand being near my sculptures and sounds and musical shows and a little bit. I also have my internal instinct is turn everything into a dance party. Like I naturally go to a very, I think a very musical place, even when things aren't musical to other people, they're to me very musical. So I don't know.
Well, to follow up on that, how are you thinking about pitch?
These are interesting. Okay, honestly, I don't think about the quality until after the fact. Like the just like all the texture, all the tones, the overtones, the harmonies, the pitch of the instrument, the all of it. Like it's like, okay, take it back. This is fun. This is very fun because there's really like these are very technical musical questions that I haven't really thought about. But as much as I don't like to control the instruments, or I have a belief that lower tones are more palatable. So with the theremin, it naturally always like it starts out like if you tone, like say I'm working with like 20 radios and 10 notes, okay? I tune them. I mean, I'm dealing with pitch. So I try to tune them as low as possible because I know that that instrument wants to rove and it wants to rove and roam upward. And eventually one or two radios are going to be annoying, really, really annoying. So often I'll have to babysit that sculpture and run around and retune when it hits pitches that I find too annoying for too long. So that, I mean, yeah, that's how I think about pitch. Is it annoying? Is it too annoying? How can I make it less annoying? And I know that with when I'm working with like the metal vibration and like the surface transducers, I straight up will like put a Bose speaker into the sculpture somewhere, like where you cannot see it, and use my iPhone and pitch a lower tone into the sculpture just to like pad it. It's the magic. And you know what? I used to be a bit more of a purist with that sort of thing, but like I started realizing that a lot of sound artists around me have use a lot of theatrics and, you know, to achieve a certain feeling or, you know, so I kind of like my practice is split into like the purist sounds and then the staged sounds, I guess you could say. And sometimes I like to stage the impalatable textures with something that can help people stand there a bit longer. And for me, that's a lower pitch. That's low. Those are lower tones.
Finally, how are you thinking about rhythm?
Ooh, back to the dance party in my mind. Yeah, mixed motor. I totally think of like that whole piece. I ended up doing a performance with it. So the way it was set up at the gallery for the pandemic was we in BC are allowed to have 10 people at a time on site. Or no, I think it was like 20 people every 2 hours or something. But I did two performances every day the gallery was open. And the gallery was a space where we could open all the doors. So everybody could be kind of like out of the gallery and looking at me performing in the gallery. So I performed with mixed motor. I had also set up in Vernon a theremin, which I hadn't done in a long time. I did like a a three-note multitonal AM radio theremin. And I did a saw performance just because I hadn't played music in a long time and I felt like doing it. So on one side of the gallery, I had that going on. The other side, I had mixed motor. And I felt like mixed motor, more than anything, was my drum machine. Like I felt like that was my percussion because it was like I really concentrated on having that. There's a lot of ways you can set it up and you can get like prolonged vibration, but there's kind of like a sweet spot where it kind of like vibrates and stops and vibrates and stops. And I felt like there's a lot of rhythm in that, and that in many regards, that sculpture became a drum machine for that gallery existence. So speaking of rhythm, I guess I'll take it where I can find it, you know, and that piece kind of can produce it. So I love that.
So Lisa, I'm wondering if someone's new to the idea of using radio in the multitude of ways you do it, but would like to integrate it into their toolbox. How would you recommend someone start?
Just get a transmitter. I mean, honestly, the transmitter is a good jumping point. Radio requires two items, a transmitter and a receiver, and if you have those, you can just start messing about. And certainly getting involved in like community radio is really easy to do. A lot of places straight up, you can volunteer and get involved like that. They're happy to teach you all sorts of things about radio. You know, there are a lot of interesting radio artists that you can look up. I feel like the most important and fruitful one would be Tetsuo Kugawa. thing about Tetsuo Kugawa is that he puts a lot of his circuits and his like, he's like a big advocate of people learning how to build transmitters and work with the technology, which is super simple. So he publishes a lot of information on his website, and he's a prof and an artist, and he's been on it hardcore since like the 80s, you know? So he's somebody that other sound artists cite all the time. And then I was lucky because I didn't touch on this, but radio was always in my periphery because I was friends with somebody named Anna Frizz. Who is a very important radio artist now, and also a professor in California and a publisher of many works about radio. It's pretty easy to find her papers. And she's been using radio creatively for like since I was like on the scene back in the 90s, even, you know, as well. So she's like a major player. And then there's something called Radio Chicago, which is Jeff Kohler predominantly pushing a project of curation mostly. I've done stuff with him or for his project with Johnny. And the thing about Radius is he spotlights all sorts of radio artists. And then also in upstate New York, there's a residency called Wave Farm. Those folks fund radio artists to come and do works on their land and then published their works. And I've worked with them as well. I've done a festival with them, and they've funded me and supported me. And there, if you go on their website, you can also learn about everybody else working with radio. If you're looking for ideas, these are really great, awesome resources. I mean, there's also a lot of like European groups, and there are like hubs and little pockets of community. And I think it's all been very supportive. It's not very competitive. Like, it's all about sharing information and sharing ideas. And there's always somebody with a little station somewhere or two, a little pirate station. There's also a fun history of like use of radio for the purpose of like, God, I heard about like DJs in London having pirate stations, and then the police would like triangulate and they'd always have to move it around because it's really easy not to get caught. And they would just like pirate radio, all this like music, you know. I love that people are taking back radio. And when we talked briefly about radio as a tool of like resistance, it's like, I'd really like to encourage people to utilize radio for any purpose, especially privately. You know, I think pirate radio is a delight, and there's been like a long history of cool projects that have been, you know, on pirate radio. Bands, there's like a band in Arizona that used to drive up to like the top of a mountain and put out flyers. I used to hear about that, and they'd be like, tune in to 90.6 and hear our show tonight, or, you know, stuff like that. There's just so much you can do with it. And I feel like it's one of the most like passed by technologies that we still use. Everybody has a radio in their car, and we all turn on CBC periodically, or, you know, listen to terrible radio. Like, it's just being blasted in a unidirectional pattern. Like, you're just used to receiving the radio. And the radio has a lot of annoying commercials and annoying voices and radio announcers. And, you know, like, the music they want you to listen to. And that's what most people probably are exposed to. And so if for me, the act of using radio for any other reason is an act of taking it back. It's an act of resistance, because that's been a government space, a corporate space. They're selling licenses and they're controlling it. And it's, you know, fine and dandy, but like, it's just so easy to jump on, and it's really hard for people to catch you. I'm not trying to encourage illegal activity, but it is just the radio. You know, I'm not saying go rob a store. Like, I'm just saying, like, grab a low power transmitter and start playing with it, because it's really fun, and you can do it respectfully too. You can find a quiet place on the waves to broadcast on that's not going to affect anybody, you know, directly. You don't need to broadcast over Virgin Radio. You can interrupt it. That's kind of fun. Yeah, it's just get a transmitter, get a radio, start playing.
Nice. Well, Gamble, thank you so much for joining me on Sound Method. This has been a thrill. Honestly, this might end up being two episodes. we'll see. Or maybe there'll be a part two later down the road. Yeah, but I really appreciate it. This was fascinating.
Anytime, Noah. Anytime. It's a thrill for me, too.
Thanks for listening to Sound Method. If you look in the show notes, you'll find that some of the topics we discussed have been linked. These links will take you to articles in the Sound Garden, a constantly growing resource drawing on the techniques, tools, compositions, and creators discussed on each episode. Next episode, I'll be joined by my new co-host and collaborator. I'll keep the surprise until then. We'll speak to sound designer Michael Tromer about spatial audio. I'm Noah Snyderman. Speak to you soon.